readers. Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so glad we're together today. With the recent shocking events in Arizona and the extreme focus on ideology, left, right, but not so much in the center, I thought this week we'd delve into books from politicians and figures on the national scene. The diversity of titles is as wide as the diversity of opinion, but no matter where you stand, there's some interesting reading out there. I vote we get started.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful, but lately you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing, but let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do, socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
My Heart, Reflections on Family, Faith, and Flag by Sarah Palin is quite frankly not my cup of tea. Party. But as Governor Palin is so often in our national spotlight, and certainly will continue to be as the presidential election heats up, I thought you might like to hear a sampling from this title. The book ranges widely over American history, culture, and current affairs. In it, Governor Palin reflects on key issues that have been such an essential part of her own life and that continue to shape her vision of America's future. In looking over the wealth of comments by readers, I discovered some found the book inspiring, but an equal number felt there were too many quotes and too much religion. With Governor Palin herself narrating, you certainly come away knowing where she stands.
Washington is spending away our kids' future, and they still want more. But the people holding the homemade signs are the ones paying the bills. If the mainstream media weren't busy insinuating that they're all racists and haters, they would have to acknowledge this fact. So the media keeps the coverage based on these patriots' motives. But what these good, honest Americans are asking for isn't ugly and dangerous. It's right there on their signs and their flags and their faces, young and old, black and white. They want their country back. I mentioned to the crowd that this year, the tax day that matters isn't April 15th, but April 9th. That's the day the average American worker finally earns enough to pay his or her federal and state taxes, which means that the average American spends the first 99 days of the year working for the government. The crowd's roar of response tells me that these Americans are feeling overtaxed by Washington. But I can tell that it isn't just high taxes that have brought these Americans here. Something bigger is going on. Something much bigger. My family and I have spent a lot of the past year traveling the country. I visited dozens of cities in more than half of the 50 states on a tour for my first book, Going Rogue, helping out candidates running for office and promoting pro-American causes. My visit to Boston was the next to last stop of the Tea Party Express in a 44-city, 3-week tour. I was there when the tour began, in the desert sands of Searchlight, Nevada, when more than 10,000 citizens turned out to take back their government. And I was there in Boston for one last rally before the tour ended on tax day in, where else when the issue is taking back our government, Washington, D.C. Along the way, I've talked to literally thousands of Americans from all across the country. I've met with folks in their living rooms, at their businesses, and at boisterous country music jamming rallies. What's more, hundreds of people have sent me books, magazine articles, snippets of speeches, and their own comments with different takes on America. What I've learned from all this traveling and meeting and talking and reading is this: the spark of patriotic indignation that inspired the Americans who fought for our freedom and independence has been ignited once again. Americans are reawakening to the ideas, the principles, the habits of the heart, and disciplines of the mind that made America great. This isn't a political awakening. It's an American awakening. It's coming from real people, not politicos or inside the beltway types. These are the Americans who grow our food, teach our children, run our small businesses, help out those less fortunate, and fight our wars. They've seen what is happening in America, so they've decided to get involved. They feel like they're losing something good and fundamental about their country. So they've decided to take it back because they love this country and are proud to be Americans. One of my first clues to how real and how consequential this awakening is came from my own independent-minded family. My Uncle Ron and Aunt Kate are business people in Washington State. They're not particularly political. They'd never been intimately involved with any party or movement. So when I found out that they had attended Tea Party meetings in the very, very early stages of this people's movement, I knew it was time to ask, who are these participants? And I realized that the Tea Partiers are my Uncle Ron and Aunt Kate, normal Americans who haven't necessarily been involved in national politics before, but are turned on to this movement because they love America and they don't like what they see happening to her. They're so concerned about the path we're on that they've decided to get involved. And believe me, they may not have done this 2 years ago, but they're doing it today. Just like at the rally in Boston, taxing and spending are the most frequent subjects of Tea Partier signs and speeches. But Americans are coming to understand that the irresponsible fiscal path we're on is just a symptom of a more serious disease. People approach me all the time to tell me they're worried that we're losing what's best about our country. President Obama and the current Washington crowd have promised us a fundamental transformation of America.
In his latest book, Pinheads and Patriots, Where You Stand in the Age of Obama, Bill O'Reilly prompts debate with the president and the American people on the current state of the Union. While the changes that took place in America during President Obama's first years in office are dizzying to think about, their real-life impact on the average American cannot be underestimated. Tempers are reaching the boiling point over the shifts in health care, immigration, national security, energy, and the environment. And then there's the economy. O'Reilly sorts it all out with his trademark mix of humor and bluster. If you tune into O'Reilly on the Tube, you'll enjoy this impassioned book, read by O'Reilly himself.
So the president was both a pinhead and a patriot. As you can see, defining his short life in consistent terms is very difficult to do because JFK was capable of both extraordinary good and incredible callousness. In the same way, President George W. Bush is a challenge to define. He did a number of truly noble things, especially during his first term. His ferocity against murderous members of Al-Qaeda likely saved thousands of American lives. His generosity in fighting disease in Africa also saved millions of lives, and that important humanitarian work continues to this day. Unfortunately, the pinhead factor exists for W. as well, because the Iraq War was not only poorly planned, but most likely unnecessary. Also, Mr. Bush's failure to aggressively oversee the economy led to the rampant speculation and financial con games that brought us down. The results were obviously catastrophic. The recession damaged the lives of countless people all over the world. But this book is not about past presidents per se. In fact, much of it will be devoted to discussing the present occupant of the White House, President Barack Obama. He is perhaps the most polarizing chief executive since Abraham Lincoln. Yes, opinions about Bill Clinton and Bush the Younger divided the country. but not in the way views about Mr. Obama have. Some Americans sincerely believe he is trying to change the fundamental core of the United States. You hear this critical refrain all the time. When do I get my country back? The Obama factor is, of course, fluid. It is being played out every day in thousands of ways. For this reason, it is imperative that you, the loyal American, continue to watch and understand its impact on your place in America. Thus, the subtitle of this book, Where You Stand in the Age of Obama, and my mandate to take a hard look at the president. On June 9, 2010, the world's most influential newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, printed an op-ed piece by Dorothy Rabinowitz, a member of the paper's editorial board. The article entitled The Alien in the White House made a devastating case that Barack Obama has little in common with working everyday Americans. Ms. Rabinowitz put forth the view that the president simply has no understanding of you and your life. As a result, his leadership is based on theory, not reality. She also asserted that Americans are beginning to notice the emotional distance between them and their leader. The op-ed was provocative and damaging to the president, especially in the midst of a brutal economy and the oil spill catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico. The polls show Mr. Obama losing the support of some independent voters and even some liberal voters. Is the president detached from your reality? Is he a man who primarily lives within himself? But this much can be said with absolute certainty about all national leaders. Sometimes they are pinheads and sometimes they are patriots, as we cited with the examples of JFK and W. But when the stakes are as high as they are right now in America, with historical debt and a war against crazy Islamic jihadists, some of whom are seeking nuclear weapons, leadership becomes amazingly important. Let's be blunt. A pinhead making a national security mistake could very well get thousands of Americans killed. And a continuation of out-of-control spending could shatter the entire economy. Therefore, I have a responsibility to provide you, the reader, with an honest appraisal of your situation in the age of Obama. I can't embrace ideology, myth, or propaganda. I've got to cut through the fog and define whether socialism, corruption, incompetence, and yes, even evil are in the air. So determining the roster of pinheads and patriots is a complicated business, as you can see. And I don't make these designations lightly. Nobody's perfect. But in most cases, a pattern of behavior does emerge. And we'll be looking for the pattern together in this book. To get us started, I have two clear examples of how I determine P&P status. Say hello to Congressman Barney Frank, and please consider the late Tony Snow.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
At the recent Miami Book Fair, I ran into John Avlon. His new book, Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America, could not be more timely. Avlon was a columnist and associate editor for the New York Sun and worked as chief speechwriter for former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. In fact, he was the youngest and longest-serving speechwriter in Giuliani's administration. After 9/11, he and his team were responsible for writing the eulogies for all the New York City firefighters, police officers, and others killed in the tragedy. He was also the director of speechwriting and deputy policy director for Giuliani's 2008 presidential campaign. Avlon has lectured at Yale, NYU, and the State Department's Visiting Journalist Program. He has appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and more. He hosts the Wingnut of the Week segment on CNN, and he is a senior political columnist at thedailybeast.com. In 2010, Avlon became a founding leader of No Labels, a citizens' movement of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, whose mission is to address the politics of problem solving. Well, we're at the Miami Book Fair, and I've just run into John Avlon, who has written a new book called Wingnuts. John, tell us about it.
Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. Wingnuts is about the rise of extremism in the first years of the Obama administration. Wingnut I define as someone on the far right wing or far left wing of the political spectrum. The professional partisans, the professional polarizers, the paranoid conspiracy theorists, the people who are always trying to divide rather than unite us. And one telltale sign of a wingnut is that they've kind of confused patriotism and partisanship. They think that being a good partisan makes you a good patriot. And in fact, the two frequently have little or nothing to do with each other. It's a pivotal time in our country to the extent that hyper-partisanship is hurting our country. It is stopping us from solving serious problems. And you've got a group of folks who, and I don't think it's going to end in media, in politics, on radio and cable TV. And they basically use hate and fear to pump up hyper-partisanship. It's become a recruiting tool, in effect. But it exerts a real cost on our democracy, because we start to demonize people who disagree with us. We start to call fellow Americans, see them as the enemy somehow. That's a problem. It's a problem that's been escalating over some time. We had Bush derangement syndrome on the left in the last presidency, and now we've got a lot of Obama derangement syndrome on the right. And sometimes they have very similar characteristics. People call the president a tyrant, a terrorist, compare him to Hitler. Well, the larger problem, and the reason I think it's important to stand up to extremes on both sides, is that, if you're only offended by the president of your party being compared to Hitler, then you're part of the problem. And right now we are in this sort of self-reinforcing dynamic where the extremes encourage each other, they empower each other, and any other way other than ugly. We need to be better, we need to be wiser, we need to recognize that we fought a lot of these forces before. And in some ways, my book was an attempt to update Richard Hofstadter's classic paranoid style in American politics, but to root it in today's politics and to say that, look, we've heard this stuff. There are echoes of past demagogues that we hear and see on television and radio, that we need to be aware of that. So we need to, call it out when we see it and try to restore our country back to some sanity, because otherwise we're in trouble.
Doesn't it kind of start right from the top with the Senate and the filibuster, and things just aren't being allowed to get done?
That is a factor. I think, if you look at this 2010 midterm elections, the American people vote for divided government around two-thirds of the time. And I do think that it's a conscious attempt to, it's an endorsement of checks and balances. I think the majority of the American people get nervous when one party is in control of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, because they think with some justification that leads to ideological overreach and legislative overreach. And I think that Democrats in particular, if you look just at the demographics of the country, always have to work a little bit harder to reach out to the center, because they don't have the numbers that conservatives do in our country. But the Republican Party is so completely controlled by conservatives right now that they're focused on kicking out their centrists. And it's a very intolerant environment in some ways. And I think that Democrats need to do some soul searching about why they lost this election. But what the partisans on both sides will say, we lost because we weren't extreme enough. No, that's almost never the case. They lose because they're perceived as being too extreme, too ideological. And what we really need to do is, like healthcare, how many times did the political leaders on both sides of the aisle say, we agree on 80%? Well, how about we start there then? But instead, we have a conversation that devolves into talk about socialism and death panels, things that are hysterical, things that are absolutely the politics of incitement. And that's what we need to confront.
So how do we begin to make changes and progress?
The conclusion of my book is called How to Take America Back from the Lunatic Fringe. I think there are things we can do from a policy prescription standpoint. I think the two most important things are open primaries and redistricting reform. Essentially, the system has been rigged by the two parties to reward the most activist, extreme members of their party, and it's having a distorting effect on our democracy. So from a process standpoint, open primaries and redistricting reform would open the process, level the playing field, and empower independent voters who tend to be a dose of sanity in elections.
What about campaign contributions, too?
Well, campaign contributions are an issue. Citizens United, if you care about civility in our politics, Citizens United is not a good decision because there's going to be more special interest money. You know, unions and corporations will be essentially unrestricted in what they can give, but they'll be able to hide it, which is tricky. That said, it's not just a function of money in politics. If the electorate was actually looked like the majority of the American people, if it wasn't distorted so that the primaries were dominated by the most extreme people, then those really negative attack ads would backfire. There's a lot of evidence to show that independent voters in particular react against negative ads. Because they rightly say this is cheap, this is divisive, and I'm not going to endorse that. So I don't think it's just an issue, but that's an important one. I think the real thing, and what I try to do in my writing and you know the work I do on CNN, is that we need to start playing offense from the center. We need to stop having our politics dominated by extremes on either side, because they end up playing a game where they incite each other, and they echo each other, and that pulls our country off center. It pulls us off course. And we need to start standing up and straightening our civic backbone and participating and pushing back. And the basic message of the book ultimately is we need to stand up to extremes on both sides, wherever we see it, if we want to stop the cycle of incitement that's preoccupying our politics right now.
Do you see that happening at a small level now?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do. There are a lot of people who are, I think, coming to the same conclusions independently, a lot of writers and thinkers, but they're politically homeless right now because neither party really represents them. Many of them are like me, say, fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And that's that demographic is essentially unmet in our politics. People will pay lip service to them, but they're not really represented in the parties. So I do think it's ultimately a matter of that old line from Gandhi about being the change you want to see. If we're concerned about the way our politics is looking and feeling in our democracy, there's a lot of temptation, and there are people who will encourage people just to drop out. They would like low turnout. I mean, you know, the parties like low turnout elections. It's much more predictable. So what we need to do is start pushing back and demanding something different and voting with our wallet as well. And because right now the publishers will say that, you know, the smart money is put out a hyperpartisan book because they know it'll sell. So we need to correct that. And that's why, you know, at the end of the day, this is a rebellious project. Right now, somehow trying to focus on what unites rather than divides us is a rebellious project in American politics and media right now. But I think it's the good fight. I think it's the right fight. So I'm happy to do it.
What would you like readers to take away from this interview right now?
You know, that stand up to extremes in your own life, that when people are preaching absolutism on either side, that they're inevitably wrong, that in a place where everybody thinks alike, no one's thinking very much, and that neither party has a monopoly on virtue or vice. But you do need to fight for what's right. You do need to fight for the idea that there more than unites us than divides us. And these snake oil salesmen who try to sell this sort of repackaged hate and fear-fueled politics and media, they are a huge part of the problem, and they deserve to be called out. And ultimately, sunshine's the best disinfectant. And if we can see it clearly, then we can beat it.
And what's the next project you're working on?
I'm doing a co-editing an anthology of America's greatest newspaper columns with two friends of mine, Errol Lewis and Jesse Angelo. So we're having fun with that.
That's great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really? And how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
So what exactly is a wingnut? In Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America, John Avlon defines the term as someone on the far right or far left wing of the political spectrum. Professional partisans, unhinged activists, and paranoid conspiracy theorists. Barack Obama campaigned as an antidote to the politics of polarization, promising to transcend the old divides of left and right, black and white, red states and blue. But in the first year of his presidency, he presided over an eruption of hate and hyperpartisanship that mocks the promise upon which he was elected. Wingnuts is an exploration of the outer reaches of American politics, told from the perspectives of a radical centrist who believes that the far right and the far left are equally insane. The author narrates.
Pumped up by the self-segregated echo chamber of talk radio, cable news, and the internet, Wingnuts see politics as ideological blood sport, an all-or-nothing struggle for the nation's soul. They are energized by dividing America into us against them. And for those with a vested interest in stirring the crazy pot, all this is good for business. Hate is a cheap and easy recruiting tool, but it can be murder on a democracy. The Wingnuts are taking flight amid the anxieties of an economy in manic recession, double-digit unemployment, deep deficits, and a decade of war. Demagogues always rise when the economy goes south, offering a narcotic for the nervous and dispossessed, with occasionally violent side effects. During the Great Depression, populist anger was directed at big business. When conservative populism reared its head in the late 1960s, anger shifted toward big government. But now we've got both. Anger at big business and big government. It's a perfect political storm, primed for return to pitchfork politics. I am not a Democrat. I am not a Republican. I'm an American. I believe the far left and far right are equally insane. But in the opening years of the Obama administration, the wingnuts on the right have been screaming the loudest. In some ways, this was predictable. Parties out of power are often dominated by their most extreme voices. Without the responsibility of governing to ground them, ideological activists preach absolutism. They try to demonize and delegitimize the new president from day one. There is no constructive assumption of goodwill, only a permanent opposition campaign. We saw this destructive dynamic at work during George W. Bush's administration when far-left protests erupted into Bush derangement syndrome, comparing Bush to Hitler, and reflexively calling for impeachment. Now the far right is out of power, and for some of them, losing an election feels like living under tyranny. Obama derangement syndrome is proliferating, pathological hatred of the president posing as patriotism. The people afflicted believe there's a sinister socialist plot to undermine our constitutional republic. It's a hyper-partisan message hammered home on our airwaves and the internet with apocalyptic urgency. The presence of the first African-American president is also driving another anxiety, the change from a traditionally white to minority-led federal government. Race has been a core wound in American politics since the original sin of slavery, but I don't believe that simple racism is motivating opposition to Obama. Instead, there is a fear that our national heritage might be eclipsed by the rise of a non-white majority in America by mid-century. We are witnessing the birth of white minority politics. As I've traveled across the country interviewing the luminaries and lowlights among the wingnuts, I've heard a consistent refrain. Armageddon days are here again. On a Saturday morning in early October 2009, I joined the Oath Keepers for their first annual meeting at the Texas Station Hotel and Casino on the fringe of the Las Vegas Strip. In a ballroom beside slot machines and frontier town facades, nearly 100 current and former military and law enforcement officers met to reaffirm their constitutional oath. On the side tables, there were images of a black-masked stormtrooper standing behind the presidential podium, with a skull imposed on the U.S. Capitol dome. There was talk of an H1N1 vaccine conspiracy, false flag operations, and concentration camps, all part of a carefully planned descent into fascism and then communism. Former Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack, a militia hero in the 1990s and advisor to the Oath Keepers, feels the anger is justified. The very people who promised us that they would protect our Constitution are the ones destroying it. He believes that President Obama violates his constitutional oath on a daily basis, probably two or three times a day. Billy Glassberg, a Nevada deli owner, counts Sheriff Mack among his heroes. He's sporting a bright yellow Don't Tread on Me t-shirt with a snakeskin cap pulled across his head and headphones around his neck. He tells me earnestly, there is a fascist takeover of America happening right now. They're trying to destroy the Constitution, enslave the American people, and create a one-world government. Garrett Lear, the so-called patriot pastor, nods his head. Dressed in a navy blue 18th century regalia complete with tri-cornered hat, the frequent speaker at Tea Party protests believes that, quote, Mr. Obama, quote, is a domestic enemy as set forth by the U.S. Constitution and should be impeached.
Revival, The Struggle for Survival Inside the Obama White House by best-selling author Richard Wolff is based on exclusive and extensive interviews with President Obama and his inner circle inside the West Wing. It is an intimate and revealing portrait of the Obama White House at work. With unrivaled access to the president and his senior staff, Wolff has written a natural sequel to his New York Times bestseller, Renegade, The Making of a President. Wolff is a veteran journalist and MSNBC political analyst who has covered the Obama campaign along the candidate's entire 21-month journey to the White House. Wolff narrates. Let's listen.
While Obama's aides did not share their thumb drives, they did share memos, PowerPoints, notes, and many hours of real-time and rear-view observations. The initial idea was to paint a portrait of a White House at work, as it pivoted from governing to campaigning in the midterm elections and beyond. The traditional notion of the first year or of the first 100 days seemed totally arbitrary. You could only tell the full story of a presidency after 4 or 8 years. So this book was intended as a picture of a work in progress, covering 30 days of action from the economy to national security. Gibbs identified mid-January to mid-February 2010 as a good month to start the stopwatch, because healthcare will be over by then, he assured me 2 months earlier. He could not have been more wrong. Healthcare, along with the presidency, moved from the disaster of the Massachusetts defeat to the realization of a Democratic dream. In a 2-month span, around the anniversary of Obama's inauguration, you could trace the arc of this presidency. On the journey from near death to rebirth, you could see the near fatal flaws and the dogged defense, the internal rifts, and the instincts that led to recovery. More than capturing the behind-the-scenes drama of the West Wing, one of my goals was to examine the core question of this new presidency. How did the president and his staff transition from campaigning to governing? The Obama White House faced a unique version of this age-old challenge. Obama had spent 21 months campaigning to be president, far longer than any of his recent predecessors. The campaign was more than just the formative experience of his aides. It was their shared identity. Not until the midterm elections of 2010 had they spent the same length of time inside the White House as on the campaign trail. For a president who had managed nothing of size until his own campaign, this was more than just a question of counting months. His adaptation from electioneering to governing, finding a balance between his campaign spirit and his presidential persona, was the essential challenge inside the Obama White House. Could he bring change to Washington without Washington changing him? When you witness how quickly presidents age in office, it is hard to believe they can pass through the Oval Office unchanged. Obama's fresh candidate face had rapidly grown as scored and worn as his temples had grown gray. Perhaps a president's core principles survive intact even as he shifts his positions on policies. But even Obama's closest aides conceded there were changes, if only in his style of decision-making. It's like watching kids grow. If you're there every day, you don't really see it, said David Axelrod, Obama's senior advisor and chief strategist. The remarkable thing about him was how natural governing was from the beginning. He looked comfortable in there on the first day. I'm too close to know how he's changed. When you have to make the kind of decisions he's made, you become wiser. I think the decision-making process becomes easier. You know what you need to make decisions, and you know what you need to get there. If Axelrod did not know how Obama had changed, other aides confessed they shared the outside world's incomprehension of Obama's true feelings. There was an inscrutable quality to his steadiness, which could make him seem calm in a crisis and clinical in a catastrophe. Did he ever enjoy the office of the presidency, which he had worked so long and hard to win? I'd love to know the answer to that question, said one longstanding aide. Does he enjoy being president? He doesn't show it. Other than getting gray hair, there seems no difference to me. He still has a sense of humor, but he's an amazingly steady guy. Others witnessed something other than steadiness. A steeliness when shutting down even close aides, and a soft touch when opening up to others. Senior staff spoke privately of policy discussions that ended with a piercing presidential stare and an icy, abrupt command from Obama. Next! That brusque manner was a stark contrast to the personal attention he paid to those who needed help. He encouraged overweight staffers to shed pounds. He gave one aide a salad for lunch, then listened to him protest that he could take care of his own health. I love you, man, said Obama. I want you to look after yourself. Eat the salad. He sympathized with staffers when the media came after them, as they came after him on a regular basis. Axelrod felt miserable when a New York Times profile criticized his own performance after the Massachusetts defeat. Later that day, Obama walked into Axelrod's office and slumped into his sofa. It's just Washington nonsense, he said. Don't worry about it. Axelrod was surprised that his boss took the time to lift his mood.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
February 6, 2011 marks the 100th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's birth. To mark the occasion, his son, Ron Reagan, has written My Father at 100, an intimate look at the life of his father, one of the most popular presidents of our time, told from the perspective of someone who knew this president better than any advisor, friend, or colleague. As he grew up under his father's watchful gaze, Ron observed the very qualities that made the future president a powerful leader and the great communicator. Yet, for all of their shared experiences of horseback rides and touch football games, there was much that Ron never knew about his father. In My Father at 100, he sets out to understand this beloved, if enigmatic, figure who turned his early tribulations into a stunning political career. Ron Reagan's book and his narration of it offer a heartfelt portrait of a man and his country, and these personal memories of the president he knew as Dad.
Setting my suspicions aside, it's conceivable the photos were donated to the library by Dad's brother Moon, I focus back on the photograph itself. It and a similarly captioned companion are the clearest look I've had at the world into which my father was born. Tampico, his original hometown, then and now a postage stamp on a flat patch of farmland in north-central Illinois, a little over 100 miles west of Chicago, looks a bare half-step evolved from Dodge City. None of the brick or clapboard storefronts stands more than two stories. The sidewalks are raised above a dirt thoroughfare, the better to keep mud and worse from being flung at pedestrians by the wheels of passing carts and carriages. There are hitching posts where parking meters might be today. Only the electrical wires strung overhead hint at modernity. The other photo provides a view across the street, with the apartment where the Reagan family lived at the time identified by an X etched in ink. Another, ruder X next door has been rubbed out. Jack had the wrong flat marked, so I put the cross on the right one, my grandmother has written below. The photographer's own caption says, "Busy day, Main Street," which appears to be no exaggeration. Outside, in the street below the flat, I count 20 horse-drawn conveyances of various descriptions, from farm wagons to sport buggies. The sidewalks are lively, mostly with men, who stand talking in small clusters in front of the post office and J.R. Howlett's hardware store. Charles Darby's tailor shop, cleaning and repairing a specialty, graciously offers those who care to linger a lunchroom. And there, in the middle of the block, its new awning capturing the photographer's attention as it would that of any potential customer, sits H.C. Pitney's competition. "John Backlund has turned the big guns loose," promises, threatens an enormous sign hung across the front of the building. Below the lettering, a caricature of a man wearing a derby and an aggressive mustache, perhaps John Backlund himself, fires a cannon at a disreputable lout representing high prices. "Every cent counts here," banners proclaim. "Big values in men's suits. Opportunity knocks today." Another, centrally positioned, reminds shoppers, "We must have cash." John Backlund isn't the sort of merchant who tolerates bumpkins showing up hoping to purchase a new Sunday suit with a basket of eggs. I can imagine Jack Reagan standing in the doorway of the Pitney store across the street, judging by the angle he could be looking over the photographer's shoulder, and casting a worried eye up at his own little sign. Referring to the view of their old apartment, Nellie has written, "Just imagine that you see me with my head stuck out the window." I peer at the fragile photograph and its plastic sleeve and do my best to comply. Casting my mind back across the years, I search for a glimpse of auburn hair, radiant in the falling light of a lingering summer evening, as my young grandmother leans out over her windowsill, hoping to catch sight of her Jack as he comes whistling his way home from another day selling shoes. These scenes from a century past are at once familiar, the Pitney store is long gone, but the building that housed it still stands, and alien. There is no mistaking it. This is a different world, one that existed a very long time ago. At the same time, it is maddeningly near, as close as a single generation. My father was born in that very flat, overlooking that same busy street filled with the comings and goings of farmers and their teams of horses. Though my grandfather, Jack, was killed by a heart attack 17 years before I was born, the woman leaning out of that window lived long enough to know me in my infancy. All at once, the reality of my father's age, the gulf separating his early small-town life in the farm country of Illinois, its rustling leaves, jingling bridles, and barnyard smells, from the hyper-cosmopolitan, pop-culture-obsessed, global-tweeting maelstrom that is modern America, comes crashing home. My father would be 100 years old by now? There's something slightly unreal about that. Is it really possible? People whose parents have reached the century mark themselves usually seem to be in their 70s or at least late 60s. Not me. At 52, I'm not even close to eligibility for the benefits of socialized medicine. I still have all my teeth and hair, though an increasing amount of gray appears to be creeping into the latter, and my dentist has of late been shooting me dirty looks.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
He set foot on it, Karl Rove has rocked America's political stage. In Courage and Consequence, My Life as a Conservative in the Fight, Rove tells his story. He ran the National College Republicans at 22 and turned a Texas dominated by Democrats into a bastion for Republicans. He launched George W. Bush to national renown. In fact, for engineering victory after unlikely victory, Rove became known as the architect. Because of his success, Rove has been accused of everything from campaign chicanery to ideological divisiveness. In this frank memoir, Rove responds to critics, passionately articulates his political philosophy, and defends the choices he made on the campaign trail and in the White House. He addresses controversies head-on, from his role in the contest between Bush and Senator John McCain in South Carolina to the charges that Bush misled the nation on Iraq. Courage and Consequence takes listeners behind the scenes of the bitterly contested 2000 presidential contest, of tense moments aboard Air Force One on 9/11, of the decision to go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and even of his painful 3 years fending off an indictment process. And, as one reviewer put it, having Rove narrate his own book puts the icing on the cake.
I will acknowledge mistakes, and I will make the case defiantly and unapologetically for many controversial decisions. I have often wondered how it was that I had landed where I have in life. There wasn't anything special about my family that would lead naturally to a front row seat to history. When I was young, my family bumped around the Rocky Mountain West, living on the shabby side of the middle class. As a geologist, my dad was often gone for months at a time on work. For a time in college, I had nowhere to live and was lucky to find a space to sleep in the unheated storage space above the porch in a fraternity house. Not exactly a grand start in life. It was, however, an appropriate one. Everyone's early life shapes their perspective. Mine grew out of Western values that emphasized limitless opportunities, even when people's circumstances constrained their lives. The experiences I had early in my life helped make me a conservative and led me both to the Republican Party and to the belief that I could make a contribution to the political battles that are the lifeblood of our democracy. What follows is an account of the arc of my life, why I bent it one way over another, and how a kid from a broken home could be called the architect by a conservative president whose courage and conviction led our nation through consequential times. A Broken Family on the Western Front. Have you heard the joke about the Norwegian farmer who loved his wife so much he almost told her? My father, Louis C. Rove, Jr., was a Norwegian, one of those taciturn Midwesterners who held back a lot. But in the last decades of life, Dad began to open up. He would reveal secrets of our family life that were shocking because they were so intimate. There's something to be said about setting the record straight, especially when it involves your kin. My father was a geologist. At about 6 feet tall, trim with short-cropped blonde hair and glasses, he had a kind but somber demeanor. Born in Wisconsin, he served briefly in the Navy at the end of World War II. Afterwards, he spent a year at Hope College in Michigan. Inspired by his uncle Olaf Rove, a consulting geologist of some renown, my father then transferred to the Colorado School of Mines in Golden, Colorado. It was there that he met my mother, Reba Wood. There were many differences. Dad was college-educated, well-read, and had grown up in a sensibly middle-class home with books, classical music, and opera. My mother never went to college, never had been exposed to books or classical music, and wasn't interested in them. While she appeared strong and in control, in reality, she was fragile. Her brittleness, emotional pain, and suffering were out of most people's view. But she and Dad were drawn to each other. He to her beauty and passion, and she to his solid dependability and dashing good looks. For a very long time, they were very much in love. Mom was the only daughter of Robert G. and Elsie Wood, and had three younger brothers. My maternal grandfather never went to college, but he was full of drive, dreams, and integrity. During the Depression, he found work on a Colorado Highway Department crew. Later, from a wooden shelf in the back seat of his car, Grandpa started selling butcher knives to out-of-the-way grocery stores in southern Colorado. He eventually built it into a business in Denver. When my grandfather died of a heart attack on Labor Day 1974, my grandmother attempted suicide by shooting herself in the stomach. She lived another 25 years in pain and loneliness, mourning her husband and, I later was to discover, indirectly showing her loved ones that suicide was an acceptable way to deal with hardship. I was born early on Christmas Day 1950 in a hospital elevator in Denver. I guess I started out eager to get going. I grew up in the genteel fringes of the lower middle class, the second oldest in what became a family of five kids, three boys and two girls. We lived in Colorado until I was nine as my father followed opportunities in the mining business. Our family first lived briefly in the company town of Kokomo near the Climax Mine north of Leadville. Then we moved to a house in a big field outside Arvada. We had a chicken coop and a garden that provided us with much-needed eggs, carrots, tomatoes, and green beans.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
As our last selection today, we'll listen to an interesting non-political look at a woman whose style and courage has made an indelible imprint on our country's consciousness, Jackie Kennedy. In Reading Jackie, the author William Kuhn takes a unique approach to examining the private Jacqueline Bouvier, the First Lady Mrs. Kennedy, and Jackie O. Jackie never wrote a memoir, but she is revealed here in intimate ways through the nearly 100 books she brought into print during the last two decades of her life as an editor at Viking and then at Doubleday. Though Jackie had a reputation for avoiding publicity, she seemed to court controversy in her books. Many of her books ran parallel to and echoed her own experience, and they certainly drew upon the intellects, national figures, and celebrities of the rarefied circles she traveled in. As a student of history, I enjoyed learning a great deal from this title. I must say I personally am not a fan of Susan Denniker's narration, her changing accents and affectations. But judging by the reviews, other readers enjoy the performance. You decide.
During one of her hospital stays, former President Nixon, now living in retirement part of the year in New Jersey, had a stroke and was sent to the same hospital. Tuckerman, as Jackie's spokesperson, fielded calls from the press. A young voice from a tabloid called to ask, "Could Mrs. Onassis and President Nixon be photographed together?" The suggestion that two seriously ill people should be wheeled into a common room for a photo op was grotesque, and also a little funny. Jackie had never been able to stand Dick Nixon, and once when he called her because he wanted her permission to publish a photograph of them together in his memoirs, she refused to return his phone calls, until one day, by mistake, she picked up the phone and there he was. "Hello, President Nixon." As Jackie's condition worsened, the press grew more impatient for news. Jackie's attitude to reporters had always been that they should be told as little as possible. As far back as the White House, her formula had been to give them minimum information with maximum politeness. Tuckerman knew that Jackie wouldn't want them to know that her illness was developing complications and becoming more serious, so her press bulletins remained opaque and featureless. This irritated the head of the hospital. He didn't want Jacqueline Onassis dying in his hospital to the surprise of the whole world. So he called Tuckerman in to upbraid her. Why, the hospital head asked her, was she telling the press that Jackie was doing as well as can be expected, when she knew, in fact, that Jackie was dying? Nancy Tuckerman defended herself as best she could. She was also under pressure from Jackie's family to divulge as little as possible about her health. Caroline and John had had trouble getting through the front doors of the hospital because of the gathered reporters and photographers. The family didn't want to encourage more crowds or speculation. Tuckerman fell back on the only human defense she could think of before the big man across the desk from her. "She's my friend, and I'm not going to say she's dying when I have not been told so." Shortly afterward, Jackie's cancer spread to areas of her body where it refused to respond to chemotherapy. The doctors had to tell her that there was nothing more they could do. Maurice Templesman was called aside to speak with one of the oncologists. Tuckerman was left alone, standing by Jackie's hospital bed. "What's going to happen, Nancy?" Jackie asked her. "You're going home, Jackie." In her last days, Jackie had enough energy to do a short walk through Central Park on Templesman's arm, placidly and unconcernedly allowing photographers to snap her picture while she was wearing a headscarf and a trench coat in the May sunshine. After a while, she went to bed. Some of her friends recall reading to her from three of her favorite books: the Danish writer Isaac Dinesen's Out of Africa, the French novelist and memoirist Colette's Cherie, whose hero was an effeminate man wearing pearls with his silk pajamas, and Jean Rhys's famous Wide Sargasso Sea, about an heiress who loved, in spite of herself, a domineering, unsuitable man. As Jackie grew weaker, however, she grew less able to resist the takeover Kennedys coming in and taking over. She'd learned to keep her distance from that family. She intended to be buried in Arlington Cemetery next to JFK, but his surviving brother and sisters had never been her best friends. They were brash, overbearing, and abrasive, everything she wasn't. One of Jackie's close friends remembered cutting short a journey to Italy and flying back to be at her bedside. As Jackie slipped into a coma, one of the Kennedy sisters posted herself in the bedroom to be a kind of public address system for Jackie's intimates, who were slipping in to kneel by the bed.
Well, we've been all over the political spectrum today. I hope you've heard a title or two you'd endorse. Thanks again to Aaron James, who always gets my vote for favorite blues artist and whose music is featured as the theme to our show. and readers. If you want more info on the books we've previewed or would like to check out other titles we've discussed in the past, check out the show's Hot Off the Press website, www.bookreportradio.com. This is your host, Elaine Charles. Keep turning those pages and be back in a week for the next chapter of the Book Report.